Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here on our final case this morning, 2021-224, the Columbus Bar Association versus Natalie Janelle Vaughn. For the respondent, Mr. Steinhelfler.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Just a brief housekeeping matter. My client, Natalie Bahan, would like to provide the courtesy to the court of making herself available to the justices should any justice have direct questions of her. We would simply ask that the court ask those questions of my client during the 4 minutes that I reserve for rebuttal. The report of the board recommended that my client be found guilty of two single violations. The first violation being of rule governing the bar for section two, failure to maintain a respectful attitude towards the courts at all times. And the second violation being a single count of rule 8.4D of the rules of professional responsibility, conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. Now, I use some interesting language to characterize that conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice accusation in our brief. I think I called it a hobgoblin or a Frankenstein's monster or something like that. In any case, I think the court need look no further than the reply brief of the Columbus Bar Association to realize I was actually quite impressed with their candor when they stated that all of these matters were for the purpose of proving a pattern of alcoholism over an 11-year period. In other words, we were dealing with seven alleged incidents that none of them, which would have independently rose to the level of conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice. I do understand why a prosecuting authority may sometimes need to set forth a complaint in that manner. And I'd like to briefly touch upon those incidents and get this out of the way before we move on to the more heavy constitutional free speech arguments. Two of the incidents deal with what the board called contacting the police over trivial matters. Well, we've scoured LexisNexis for cases where people have gotten in trouble for contacting the police over trivial matters and were simply unable to find very much on point. I think the reasons for that are probably pretty obvious in the chilling effects that that would have on people's ability to contact the police when they need to do so. It's especially important in this case where there was a history of domestic violence, which is part of the record in this case. We wish it were not, but it was published by the relator, and it is. And so I think those reasons are there. As far as establishing a pattern of alcoholism, they simply failed to do that by clear and convincing evidence. What we have are three incidents, one which involved a glass of wine before an intentional guardian ad litem visit 11 years ago. And I'll get into other states that have applied latches to situations like this, such as the Virgin Islands or Indiana, which we cited in our supplemental authorities. But I do not think this court even needs to go that far on this to say that we would apply a concept such as latches to a disciplinary action. Because if you look at the record, it just didn't amount to clear and convincing evidence. The fact that the one testifying witness did not have a memory of what year it occurred, could have been a 5-year span is what he testified to, or even whether he asked my client to resign as guardian ad litem afterwards. My client had a very clear memory of that, that being her very first case as a guardian ad litem. And in fact, both my client and the relator's testifying witness were unanimous in the fact that that very judge, the relator's witness, appointed my client as a guardian ad litem in children's services cases many times afterwards, after that incident. And so we're dealing with a case, an incident 11 years ago, which probably nobody thought it was prejudicial to the administration of justice at the time. Now memories have faded to the point that it's to the prejudice of my client, were that to be the basis for discipline. And I don't think that we really need to talk too much more about that. Now, with regard to their case on alcoholism, we have the one glass of wine 11 years ago. We have the contention that she was intoxicated of a Saturday night and a Sunday night over a course of an 11-year period of time. If this is the type of thing that is prejudicial to the administration of justice, I would submit that this court would find itself doing, not having time to do very much more than hear these types of cases. They simply did not prove this count by clear and convincing evidence. And what we've provided in our list of supplemental authorities is that there's a couple competing standards among cases or states that have provided a little more guidance, we'll say, to the bar as to what is prejudicial to the administration of justice, and one we like more than the other. The first one, which we don't prefer, is that the state of Maryland says that the conduct has to either be criminal or egregious. The one that we find to be a little more thoughtful is the Iowa Supreme Court Disciplinary Board versus Templeton, which is a 2010 case, in which they explain that conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice only applies to those violations of well-understood norms and practices. And they cite to the ABA House of Delegates that drafted the rule. So I think that really goes to the intent. And if this court were to give that guidance to the attorneys of this state, I think it would be doing us a service. Now, on to the speech matter. There was a holiday party out here in Logan County in 2018. There's something called an Elvis Award, which the person who brought the grievance to the Bar Association, is former Judge Gosley, was being roasted, is what he said in the initiating grievance. He called it a roast. So this is a mock award for something foolish somebody has done, usually something lighthearted. Now, something a little different happened on this particular year because even though attorneys will show up to this, and by the way, the audience was limited to attorneys and their spouse if they had one, is what the witnesses testified to. So it was a rather insular audience, although I'm sure any of you may be able to wrangle up an invitation to that Logan County Bar Association Christmas party. I could not because I was not an attorney at the time. So it was a rather insular audience. My client arrived to that party to surprise, to find out that former Judge Gosley, a judge at the time, was being awarded for what she believes, and we think quite objectively reasonably, was Judge Gosley's own judicial misconduct in calling an indigent female pro se litigant who struggled with addiction hopeless from the bench. And so, she called him, she said what she said. She called him a f-ing piece of shit and an ass. And this may have started, you know, quietly to people at her table. And as they said, you know, be quiet, you know, she's arguing, no, he is da 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 da. We shouldn't be giving them him this award. He's a, in fact, this. And so I think under the standard that this court has set forth in Gardner, you have to view whether she had an objectively reasonable basis for that opinion. Now, Gardner was a 2003 decision, and since then, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals has handed down Berry versus Schmidt, which provides even further protections to statements of opinion. And I don't think I need to get too much into the gritty nitty of why what she said was a statement of opinion. Otherwise, this could become quite farcical and below the dignity of the court. But they were statements of opinion. And under Berry, all that's necessary for that to be constitutionally protected is that the reasons for those opinions have to be known to the people hearing them. Well, the reasons for those opinions were known to the people hearing them if he's up there getting an award for those very reasons. You know, talking about why I'm getting this award, it was known. The facts on which those opinions were based were known. So there was an insinuation in the report of the board that it had to do with some underlying feud between the two.
Counselor, excuse me. Yes. Your position can't be that any opinion an attorney or judge has, no matter what the language they use, is fine as long as there's opinion. So if I look at the Chief Justice and call her a bunch of names, it's okay because that's my opinion.
It is not my position, Justice DeWine.
That seems what you're saying, right? You're saying it doesn't matter what her state was, what the actual word she used, but since it's her opinion, it's all right.
That is not my position, Justice DeWine. There are, in fact, four states in this country that do take a position similar to that. Texas, Wisconsin, Colorado, and Oklahoma have adopted the New York Times versus Sullivan standard when it comes to attorney speech criticizing the judiciary.
So an attorney could walk in and say to the judge, you're an effing a-hole, and that would be okay.
No, I would like you to take a more thoughtful approach, which is actually the approach taken by another state within the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and that would be Tennessee. If you compare the Ramsey case, which is a 1989 case, to the Parrish case in Tennessee, which is 2018, the critical factor is, was the attorney acting in a representative capacity, and did it have to do with an ongoing case? Because otherwise, we're imposing unconstitutional conditions on someone's right to practice law. Counselor, and that would be our position.
Counselor, does it matter where these things are said? Is it different if they're said in a banquet hall as opposed to in a courtroom?
I would like you to consider that, Your Honor, because I think that when you're in this insular audience of interested people, the underlying justification for the rule which she's alleged to have violated do not weigh as heavily.
Well, and also, does it matter the profanities hurled at the judge were profanities that it didn't necessarily relate to, at least on their face, judicial conducts or his judicial temperament or any judicial decision? So does that matter? So for instance, could the exact same words have been hurled by Ms. Behan at the judge on a public sidewalk downtown in response to his breaking her sister's heart because they broke up or something like that?
It's an interesting question. It's not the facts before us. I do think it matters that it was political speech because it had to do with his own violations of the rules governing the judiciary. And if there's no more questions, I see that I've really gone beyond my time.
Thank you.
Are you saying, let's assume that Justice or Judge Gosling made a statement, okay?
Okay, who's speaking? Who's speaking at this point?
Justice Fischer.
Yeah, I thought.
It's not coming clear.
Sorry, is that better?
No.
Okay. I'll let it go, let's move on.
Okay. All right, we're going to hear then from Mr. Marcus.
No, Your Honor, I'm calling.
I'm sorry. Ms. Briscoe.
Yes. Good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor and members of the court. My name is Colleen Briscoe, and I am actually arguing here on behalf of the relator, the Columbus Bar Association. First, I want to address a couple cases that Mr. Steinheffler, sorry if I mispronounce your name, mentioned. First of all, the Templeton case in Iowa, that attorney received a 2-year suspension, and there were mental health components. So the sanction was then reduced to 3 months. In Berry versus Schmidt, that was a defamation case. And the court points out that in ethics cases, lawyers are held to a higher standard than in a defamation case. With that, I will say that we never tried to prove alcoholism. The count he's referring to is 23 in our complaint. And all we were saying is that there was behavior that involved alcohol, and that was what we were asking the court to consider. We can't prove alcoholism without appropriate evaluation. To a great extent,
he was evaluated by OLAP, but the panel found that essentially she wasn't appropriate for the program.
They did not do, well, she was resistive. They did not do an alcohol evaluation. They will tell you they don't do that.
I know that OLAP now also deals with mental health. And for instance, I mean, just by way of example, if a person were taking some kind of medication, sometimes one drink might have an effect, but none of that was really explored, correct?
Apparently not. They were looking for a voluntary for her to voluntarily work with them. She did go to 2 meetings with OLAP, but they did not do any extensive evaluations.
Thank you.
I guess I'm a little concerned about this allegation or incident from 11 years ago that she had one glass of wine and before she visited her guardian, when she was a guardian ad litem, and the judge apparently dealt with it. The judge apparently didn't feel like it was an ethics violation, or he would have had an obligation to report it. I see in your briefing you say, well, we're not talking about one. We're putting all these together, but I don't know how the whole can be greater than the sum of the parts. If something's not an ethics violation, then you can put it together all you want, but still is not an ethics violation. So help me with that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't mean to interrupt. There were 7 incidents. We were trying to show a pattern of conduct. The panel decided to treat them all as separate counts. And they found her basically to have violated the rules on 3 of those counts. One was indeed the drinking alcohol before making a planned guardian ad litem visit. She claimed she had one glass. We have no way of knowing. She and Judge Chamberlain had extensive conversations about it. And if you read the record, he basically had to convince her that this was not appropriate behavior. I realize it was long ago, but it was just one of the 7 incidents we listed. And they treated it as a separate count and found a violation of 8.4D.
But again, I mean, at least if Judge Chamberlain thought it was a violation, then he would have been obligated to reported. As far as we know, he didn't do that. I mean, there's not much precedent for, it seems like poor judgment. I'm not sure it's an ethics violation.
I understand that, Your Honor. He did not report it. So she was basically found to have violated governance rule 4.2 because she went to a holiday party. It's an annual bar event. There were over 50 people there. It is not limited to spouses. The people there were the judges, attorneys, their spouses, their friends or dates, and as well as people working in the venue. So there were a lot of people there. Ms. Behan, according to three witnesses, began calling the judge foul names. The one that Mr. Seinheffler left out was he was also called, excuse me, a mother. She said it quietly at the table, perhaps, and three of her colleagues admonished her to stop saying that. She got up and moved, stood against the wall, and said it loudly enough that virtually everybody in the room could hear it, and persisted in saying it. Eventually, she was drinking that evening. And I think Judge Chamberlain said she was unsteady on her feet. That's what he noticed. But then Ms. Behan proceeded to, as one of our witnesses put it, get in Judge Gosley's personal space. He had had foot surgery and was not entirely mobile and was standing with his back to a door jam. And Magistrate Kennedy, who was one of our witnesses, actually warned the judge to be careful because Natalie seemed so agitated and so angry that she might in fact hurt the judge by inadvertently knocking him over. In addition, she was finally, before it went much further, escorted out by another attorney there, Sheila Minnick, and her husband, who according to Bridget Hopkins actually kind of got her to leave before it went any further. The entire room was shocked. They were embarrassed. That was the description. And she basically was simply spewing epithets at the judge. I have problems believing this is protected political speech, or as they describe it, moral suasion. So there were three arguments. And finally, the last part is the president of the bar, Miranda Warren, had to apologize the next day on behalf of Ms. Behan to the caterer because she felt it was so out of line and she was embarrassed about it. She said it was an embarrassment to the bar. Their first argument is this isn't against the courts. Rule for governance of the bar, rule 4, section 2 is quoted. But it goes on to talk specifically about judges and justices needing protection, needing support. So it clearly was against, when you berate a sitting judge like this, call him foul names in public, it is against the courts. It was not in pleadings, but there are violations that were that have been found by this court outside of the court. DeCato.
Would it have been a violation if this was another attorney she had this loud outburst at the holiday party? And does it matter that it was a judge? I mean,
I think it could be another attorney. We take an oath of office, though, and we agree not to show courtesy and respect to judges. That is part of our oath we take to become attorneys. So it is especially bad when you have a sitting judge and you are berating him before the public. Now, I realize most of these people were attorneys, but they're all his colleagues, other judges. It had to be horribly embarrassing. But as I said, it doesn't have to be in the courthouse. It can be outside the courthouse. DeCato, Ferrari, and Erie County versus Bailey all involve statements about judges outside the courthouse. There's also an argument that you must find a violation of the professional rules, not just governance of the bar rule. You need look no further than governance of the bar rule 5, which defines misconduct as a disobedience to these rules and goes on to give the court jurisdiction to hear evidence and punish for violation of the governance of the bar rules. Now, we feel that she was guilty of 8.4, violation of 8.4H, but that is not reviewable under the current state of the law. So, but we do feel that she was guilty of that also and would ask the court to take a look at that. Finally, there's the protected under the First Amendment. Lawyers are held to a higher standard in ethical matters than in defamation matters or contempt matters. And spewing epithets, as I said, is not moral suasion or political speech. This is a behavior slash words where she's yelling at the judge these horrible things.
May I ask a question?
Certainly.
Would, if these things were hurled at the judge, the same exact words on some personal matter, is she prohibited from doing so, or is the judge protected from these profanities toward him because he's a judge?
He's protected either way. I think that it is an ethical matter. It's not a criminal matter. It's not a defamation matter. It's an ethical matter that if she's going to stand before a judge and call him these kind of foul names, I think it is a problem. I think it is an ethical violation. And I want to point out that the argument about what the judge said was not in the record. That was specifically ruled to be irrelevant by the panel. So the statements by the judge that Mr. Steinheffler is indicating were not in the record itself. Beyond that, Gardner makes it clear that attorneys may not invoke the federal constitutional right of free speech to immunize themselves, citing the Sawyer case, and even outside the courtrooms, lawyers are subject to ethical standards. This court has a compelling interest in maintaining respect for the court by the public, and this kind of behavior totally undermines that interest. As to count two, there were seven incidents that she was found to have clear violations on three. Two of them involved deployment of law enforcement. The first one was in 2019. She had a fight with her husband at a charity event, called 911, reported a man named William Brannon had stolen her car. That's in Exhibit 7. Didn't say it was her husband, said it was just a man. She, in her testimony, said she was willing to have him arrested. She was drinking that night, and the deputy, in following up, went to her home and found that she was intoxicated. Her husband had not in fact left the party as she believed. He had stayed at the party and he drove her home a few minutes later. She was angry at her husband, and so she called the deputies and said someone had stolen her car. Incident two occurred in 2017 involving our witness, Deputy Wood. She called to report that her son had stolen her iPad, the son who lived with them. The deputy called to follow up, and she sounded intoxicated on the phone. The husband called in at the same time, said she was intoxicated and basically out of control. During the time the police officers were there, she was loud, uncooperative, disrespectful, cursed the deputies. They had to physically restrain her to allow her husband to leave. They were trying to get her husband out of the house, not because of his behavior, but because of hers. And I would ask the court to listen to the tape we submitted as an exhibit, Exhibit 6, which gives a clear indication of her behavior during that incident, or part of it at least. The other incidents were simply trying to show that she has a pattern of behavior, but those are the three that she was found to have violated. Since I don't have a lot of time, I want to move on to witnesses. The spirit and purpose of case management rules are so that discovery can proceed. Two dates went by when witness lists were to be exchanged. The bar submitted its list in March. The respondent never submitted a witness list until the final list a week before the final hearing. That does not allow discovery to proceed. We had no reason to believe she had witnesses other than herself. And at the hearing, there was no proffer as to the testimony. So no prejudice could be inferred from the lack of testimony. So I don't think that the court can rule that she was in any way prejudiced by her failure to be able to put on full testimony from her witnesses. As to sanctions, a 6-month suspension fully stayed is the most lenient after she's already had a prior public reprimand. And not coincidentally, the episode at the holiday party occurred about 4 days before she was to go to trial on her first discipline case. That was a discipline action that Judge Gosley had filed. But in any case, she's prior discipline, pattern of misconduct, multiple offenses, and refusal to acknowledge guilt. And in fact, they cite Decato, where the attorney called a judge's bailiff and called the judge, quote, a lying and apologized, and it wasn't made public, and those were found to be mitigating factors. Those mitigating factors don't exist here, and that attorney received a 6-month stayed suspension. So I would ask the court to uphold the findings and recommendations of the panel as to the violations, and consider the sanction as a minimum sanction, given that she's already had a public reprimand. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Your Honor, first of all,
counsel, let me just advise you, you've got no time left, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, Berry versus Schmidt was not a defamation case. It was an attorney discipline case in Kentucky involving the right of the Kentucky bar to discipline its own attorneys, and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals declined to apply the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. In Decato, that attorney was in fact acting in a representative capacity. When opposing counsel talks about the lack of presentation of witnesses, I think that's an important point, because I think the worst case scenario for us is that this gets kicked back to the panel because she did not get to present her witnesses. There was in fact a proffer as to the testimony of Mark O'Connor, but we need not let insist that her former counsel be so disrespectful to the panel to object over and over and over. His objections were in there, in the record, and preserved instead of waived. Ruffalo, a decision for the United States Supreme Court on remand from this very court in 1968, demands that attorneys be afforded due process, including the presentation of witnesses. As well as many other cases we cited on there. And with that, this has been an honor of a lifetime, and I'll leave it to your sound discretion.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please?